The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I'm going to give a shout out to Paul in a minute here. So, I want to start by just reading a pretty prominent quote, or at least I think it is. Today, no Marxist thinker after the classical epoch is so universally respected in the West as Antonio Gramsci, nor is any term so freely or diversely invoked on the left as that of hegemony, to which he gave currency. Now, those are the two opening sentences of the probably the most well-known article written in English about Gramsci. It's Perry Anderson's The Antinomies of Antonio Gramsci, published in New Left Review in 1976. And I start that way because I think actually that Anderson's statements are still largely true today, 42 years later. I mean, perhaps we can debate whether hegemony is as widely used as it was then. Maybe some other term like neoliberalism or intersectional or whatever might lay a claim to that sort of terminology on the left today. But I think it's still pretty much the case. Like Gramsci remains one of the most well-respected classical Marxists, perhaps second only to Marx himself. In fact, Gramsci has seemed to have attracted a new following in the midst of the growing interest of, in socialism today. Now, there are obviously many good reasons, and hopefully I'll enumerate some of them, why Gramsci is popular and remains so. They lie in his novel analysis of key strategic and theoretical questions in Marxism. But there are also some really bad reasons for their interest in Gramsci among some on the left. And for these people, Gramsci is seen as a Western Marxist who offers a more subtle and thoughtful alternative to the crude Marxism of figures like Lenin, the nasty old Lenin, or the intransigent Trotsky. For a generation of Eurocommunists, the movement in the 1970s of the old European Communist parties to remake themselves as sort of responsible parties in government and proponents of attainable reforms, Gramsci was held up as a sort of prophet or patron saint. And today, when there's not much left of the Eurocommunist project, but there is a renewed interest in left reformism or social democracy, Gramsci is being repurposed. For example, the leaders of Podemos, some like Pablo Iglesias, who have their roots in Eurocommunism, often deploy hegemony as a way to explain their rhetorical strategy of trying to create a new political narrative for the left, moving away from sort of those old hoary Marxist concepts like class, for example. Another can be found in a Jacobin article was written a few years ago entitled Gramsci Comes Home, where the author writes about the experience of the NGO City Life, or Vida Urbana, in organizing the anti-foreclosure movement in the wake of the 2008 crash as an experiment in Gramscian work to create counter-hegemony and a new common sense. Today, when someone uses the term Gramscian, they're usually invoking it as a kind of alternative to a term like Leninist or revolutionary. If people reviewed socialist workers' syllabus selection for this meeting, they'll find that the social democratic writer Kate Aronoff invoked Gramsci to criticize people on the left who supported Greens over Democrats in the 2016 election. So Gramscian is often used as a kind of shorthand that places an emphasis on cultural or ideological work, or suggests a gradualist sort of approach, a march through the institutions instead of a revolutionary rupture. I'm talking about not Gramsci himself, I'm talking about other people that use the concepts that he has or misuse them. So I'm not sure that Gramsci would describe himself as a Gramscian in the way that his followers have invoked him. At the least, the picture of Gramsci I've described above would seem to be odd to someone who was the founder and early leader of the Italian Communist Party, who was known for his commitment to workers' revolution from below and his harsh condemnation of the reformist leaders and organizations of his day. At one point in the prison notebooks, about which most of this talk is going to focus on, he compares the reformist leaders of the Socialist Party and the trade union leaders to a beaver who hunted for its supposed medicinal qualities of his testicles, decides to save himself by chewing off his own testicles. I'll leave you with that, you know, image and think about what that means. But it certainly doesn't say that he has much of an appreciation for reformist leaders. He died in 1937 after serving most of his last 11 years of life in a fascist prison. And while there, he never renounced his commitment to Marxism, communism, or to revolution. Now, while Gramsci had an extensive public record before his imprisonment, the revival of interest in Gramsci after the Second World War came with the publication of his prison notebooks. This is an old version of the kind of selections that are translated in English from the 60s. It's probably in the book room today. These were a collection of like 33 bound notebooks compiled over 7 or 8 years where Gramsci wrote on all sorts of topics. When he died, the notebooks fell into the possession of figures associated with the Communist Party, the Italian Communist Party, and following the war, selections of them were published under the editorship of the main Communist Party leader at the time, Palmiro Togliatti, a Stalinist ideologue. Now, since there was so much in the notebooks, Togliatti's selective reordering and release of parts of their contents was intended to provide a Gramsci seal of approval on the Communist Party's policies at any particular time. At one point, Togliatti presented Gramsci as a great intellectual, heir to the Italian liberal tradition dating all the way back to Machiavelli. At a different point, the Communists presented him as the inspiration for the Italian road to socialism. Now, over the next few decades, as the prison notebooks was translated into different languages, different interpreters emphasized different aspects of Gramsci's work. The British intellectual Stuart Hall appropriated Gramsci to analyze Thatcherism as an exercise in hegemony and transforming free market ideology into common sense. The academics Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe, in their Hegemony and Socialist Strategy, disconnected the idea of hegemony from any anchorage in class politics and making hegemony mainly a question of ideological discourse. So while Gramsci's message has been de-radicalized and appropriated for multiple different purposes, we should also note that the prison notebooks can lend themselves to these interpretations, especially if they're read outside of an understanding of Gramsci's pre-prison activism. The notebooks are obtuse, ambiguous, or fragmentary in places, which opens the door to various readings that are not in the spirit of Gramsci's commitment as a revolutionary socialist. I hope I can help to disentangle some of those and to establish that Gramsci, as Engels said about Marx, was above all a revolutionist. Now, I'm not going to take up a lot of time with the biography of Gramsci for people who do want that, and here's the shout out to Paul. I'd urge them to check out Paul D'Amato's talks from the conference several years back. They're on We Are Many. I will kind of go through the broad outline, and just so people know, I will not consider myself any kind of Gramsciologist, so don't stand up and read me some quotation out of the prison notebooks and ask me to interpret it. I want to have a discussion about the kind of general picture of what's there, and hopefully make an argument that will be at least convincing enough where we spark debate about it. So to go back to Gramsci, I I'm not going to go through a great long biography. I'll just give some broad outline of this. He's born in 1893 in Sardinia, grows up in hardship. He wins a scholarship at the University of Turin at age 18. He joins the Socialist Party in 1913, but he's not actually really conversant in Marxism until years after that. In his activism and his writing, he develops a critique of the existing Italian Socialist Party. The PSI, or the Socialist Party, that was founded in 1892, is a broad church with a left, a right, and a center, like most of the Social Democratic parties at that time, or the Socialist parties at that time. And positions in the government, it had positions in the government at all levels. Its version of Marxism tends to be the reigning one of the Second International, an economic determinist and fatalist, because it assumes that capitalism will inevitably collapse. Practice consists of running for office and heading up unions. It includes a maximalist, minimalist wing that puts forth these sort of minimal demands, and a maximalist wing that combines a kind of extreme verbal radicalism, they're for smashing capitalism and so on, but with practical passivity. So Gramsci condemns that posture as he's drawn more to the view of Marxism and the fight for socialism as what the Italian Marxist philosopher Antonio Labriola called the philosophy of praxis. It's an active conception that made the working class struggle the driving force of Marxism. In fact, the revolutionary syndicalists and the French anarchist George Sorel's, along with Labriola, have much more influence on Gramsci than do figures like Kautsky or other leading Marxists of his day. His conception of Marxism in some ways is captured in 1917 when he writes an article about the Russian Revolution entitled The Revolution Against Capital. Although, like many of the other Italian socialists, he doesn't know that much about what happened in Russia, who the different figures are, and so on, he congratulates the Bolshevik Party for its acting to change history. He says the Russian Revolution is a revolution against capital, as he calls it, because of the audacity of the Bolsheviks and the Russian working class to fight and win socialism. Against the dominant view in the Italian Socialist Party that capitalism's economic contradictions that Marx outlined in Capital would undermine it and deliver it over to the socialists, you know, the sort of a collapse of its own weight. It's a revolution. So he sees the Russian Revolution as a revolution against that mechanical, passive view of Marxism that the socialists of the day based on their reading of Capital. Now, he's based in Turin, in northern Italy, which is the center of industry in Italy, and particularly the auto industry, where the Fiat works are. It was has a very active and combative labor movement whose social power and weight are greatly increased in the war, the First World War economy, after Italy enters the First World War in 1914. Gramsci's involved in the socialist youth, and later he leaves university to become a full-time socialist journalist, I think short of actually getting his degree. Now, a few months into 1918, Gramsci and other comrades form the newspaper Ordine Nuovo, or the New Order, and it represents a kind of current within the Socialist Party. Its banner slogan is something probably people have heard before, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, reflecting the early syndicalist influence his early syndicalist influence and what he knew about the Soviets and Russia. Ordine Nuovo proposes that workers form councils in the factories and from there work to displace capitalists and to take over all of society. Gramsci and Ordine Nuovo win a following among the Turin working class, and that in the crisis following the end of the First World War creates a huge clash between the working class and the bosses. This leads to two waves of mass factory occupations in 1919 and 1920, which also at the same time there were like peasant uprisings, land occupations as well. Now the Socialist Party at the time, which is rhetorically revolutionary but practically passive, fails to provide leadership in the growing revolutionary situation that culminates in the occupation of the factories. Gramsci says famously that the situation is one in which will either lead to workers' power or a tremendous reaction. And he has growing scorn for the inability of the SP to unite the working class and to lead the revolutionary struggle. And when the movement is defeated, fascism begins to grow as a means to smash the workers' movement once and for all. Mussolini and the black shirts then seize power in 1922. Again, I'm not going to say that much more about this, but I just wanted to indicate there are several talks on the factory council movement in the We Are Many collection. So it's in those unfavorable circumstances, and I probably should underline unfavorable circumstances, that the Communist Party is formed in 1921 by splitting away from the left wing of the Socialist Party. It's dominated by the ultra-left Bordiga, who opposes all forms of compromise and alliances in order to preserve revolutionary purity. Gramsci goes along with this, and only after spending time in Russia and attending the Comintern's Fourth Congress in 1922, and particularly as a result of intensive debates with Trotsky, is he convinced of the need for a united front in Italy against fascism. So with the Comintern intervention and with the aid of Togliatti and other leaders, he pushes Bordiga aside and he becomes the Communist Party's, one of the main Communist Party leaders in 1923, 1924. This is just as the Trotskyist opposition is starting to form in Russia, and Stalin is also beginning to consolidate his bureaucratic hold in Russia at the time. So though Gramsci expresses some sympathy for in letters with concerns of Trotsky, or at least says that Trotsky shouldn't be cast out, that his debate, you know, what he's raising is something worth discussing. He sides with Stalin, albeit critically, and for the Stalinists as well. He never publicly confronts the full weight of Stalinism, however, because he's arrested 2 years later and spends virtually the rest of his life in prison or in confinement. Now, he's convicted in 1928 and given a 20-year sentence, long enough, the fascist prosecutor said, to prevent his brain from functioning. And as it turned out, his writing of the notebooks kept his brain functioning even while his body was dying a slow death over 9 years. He had all sorts of ailments, disabilities that, you know, progressively weakened him over the time that he was in prison. What we do know is that according to reports from other communist prisoners, he strongly condemned the Stalinist third period, which was dictated starting in 1928, that revolution was now on the agenda, brought on by impending world crisis, and that the task for socialists were no longer a united front, but to denounce all non-communist workers' parties, reformists, as social fascists and refuse any alliances with them in purposes of struggle. That's famously summed up in the CP slogan in Germany before Hitler's accession to power, you know, after Hitler, our turn. Now that's a quick summary of Gramsci's pre-prison career that captures some of the themes that reemerge in his writing later. The experience of the factory council movement is formative to him. I think it provides a framework in which he understands the struggle for socialism subsequently. And I think the other main preoccupation of his, and especially in his main sort of time as leading the CP, is his preoccupation with the necessity of revolutionaries to implement a united front as a way of building up the forces of the working class in a situation in which they are on the defensive so they can achieve a revolutionary transformation of society in the future. So it's not that Gramsci, largely, that the Western academics and reformists claim as their own. It's the Gramsci they divine through reading the prison notebooks that he left behind when he died. Again, the notebooks consist of many handwritten, 33 handwritten volumes of student binders with reflections on multiple topics. They're full of half thoughts and difficult prose, and they have it many times, and many times they're deliberately obtuse. Remember, Gramsci is writing on understanding that Mussolini's censors and possibly Stalin in Russia, where Gramsci's wife and children are living during the purges that are going on in the 1930s, are reading them too. But several themes do emerge from them, and the case that Gramsci was a reformist or moving towards reformist conclusions are constructed from these. So if I could sort of say what I think that core case is. One of the notebook's recurring themes is the difference between capitalism and the state in, quote, the East, essentially Russia, and Western Europe. In the famous passage, Gramsci says that in the East, the state was everything, civil society was primordial and gelatinous, and that in the West, where the relationship between civil society and the state was proper, there was a dense set of what he calls earthworks, or organizations that stand between the working class and state power. In Russia, the underdeveloped state of trade unions, political parties, and civic organizations meant that the working class could mount just a direct assault on state power. In the West, however, there are far more obstacles to that direct assault on power. Capitalism is much stronger, and because of this, the reformists argue, the revolutionary reform, the revolutionary road to socialism is ruled out in the West. So this difference between East and West, therefore, requires different tactics. So socialists in the East could mount what Gramsci called a war of maneuver, or a quick assault on power. But socialists in the West had to adapt to a long and slow, what he called, war of position, or of partial victories and setbacks over a long period of time. In the East, the state dominated the working class by force. And in the West, the hegemony of the ruling class was more subtle and based on consent of the oppressed. Realizing this, socialists had to concentrate on challenging those aspects of consensual hegemony through propounding a counter-hegemony that would undermine the ruling class's hold on the working, or what he often called the subaltern classes. By the way, and people may be more familiar with this, I don't know how many times he ever really uses the word or term counter-hegemony. I think that's something that's more something that people writing about Gramsci say more than he did, but I could be wrong about that. Anyway, the differences between the East and West, the concentrating on the long, slow war position and the largely ideological struggle for hegemony form the core of the Euro-communist or the reformist case. In the most developed form, it sees Gramsci as a theoretical elaboration of the practice of the post-Second World War European Communist Party, Western European Communist Parties, that of what they called the long march through the institutions, not just working to attain positions and influence in the trade unions, the state bureaucracy, the universities, and so on, but to win positions in city councils, subnational governments, and parliament. And in that way, you start with what sounds like radical theory, but you turn it into reformist practice. And remember that most of this use of the prison notebooks is taking place at a time when the Western Communist parties are eager to show themselves to be reliable partners in government with various centrist and national capitalist forces in Italy, France, and so on. It's no wonder that the, Italy and Spain, and it's no wonder that the goal of socialism is pushed farther into the future and actually out of sight. So that's the brief version of the case that Gramsci was a sort of patron saint of Western Marxism. Okay, so that's the brief version. I won't even make a joke about that because I can't think of one right now. Anyway, so that's the brief version of the case that Gramsci was a sort of patron saint of Western Marxism, who charted a more realistic and less revolutionary course for socialists in the advanced capitalist world. I'm going to contend this is a distortion of what Gramsci stood for, both before he was in prison, obviously, and while he was writing the prison notebooks. Now, Gramsci always thought that he was elaborating on Marxism and Leninism. Rather than breaking with Lenin, he believed he was picking up where Lenin left off. In fact, the famous passage about East and West that I read above follows only a few lines after he writes, "It seems to me that Ilyich," that's his kind of code word for Lenin, "understood that change was necessary from the war of maneuver applied victoriously in the East in 1917 to a war of position, which was the only form possible in the West." Then subsequently writes, "That is what the formula of the United Front seems to me to mean." Now, he considered himself a Leninist and a revolutionary to the end, but to understand what his purposes were, you have to understand the political questions he was trying to answer. So I'll try to outline the ways that I think we should understand the concepts that Gramsci was developing and how they related to the political questions he was trying to answer. So first, let's take the question about East and West. I've alluded earlier, Gramsci was well within the mainstream of the communist movement as represented in the first four congresses of the Comintern. Lenin had earlier criticized approved theses of on the party as being, quote, too Russian, i.e. that the Russian experience couldn't simply be mapped on to other national experiences without taking account of local conditions. In the third and fourth congresses, the Comintern was coming to grips with the fact that the post-World War I revolutionary upsurge had subsided and that the revolution hadn't broken through in the West. So much discussion was given over to the differences between the Russian experience and the experience of revolutionaries in the West. Trotsky himself spoke about this at the Fourth Congress with Gramsci in the audience, in attendance. Among other points, Trotsky says that the Bolsheviks caught the Russian ruling class by surprise, but that the Western ruling classes are much more sophisticated and able to throw many more obstacles in the way of the working class. So that was a theme that Gramsci developed as a leader of the Communist Party. In a 1926 speech to the Communist Party executive, he says, "In the advanced capitalist countries, the ruling class possesses political or organizational resources that it did not possess, for example, in Russia. This means that even the most serious economic crises do not have immediate repercussions in the political sphere. Politics is always one step behind, or many steps behind, economics." In another statement a couple years earlier, he makes a similar observation. He draws a political conclusion that the Revolutionary Party must adopt a more complex and long-term strategy than the Bolsheviks were able to use in the 6 months of 1917.
Samsung.
Off. All right. So the idea that he's developing the idea that communists in the West, or communists in Italy in particular, have to have a longer term strategy than the Bolsheviks had in 6 months of 1917. So the point here is that the supposed cornerstone of Western Marxism is really Gramsci's elaboration of a common discussion among revolutionaries in the early 1920s. Gramsci did develop the theory in new and different ways. His concept of the integral or extended state, where he defines the state in a much broader context than just bodies of armed men, or as Engels called them, or the repressive apparatuses of the state, including its power to incorporate and shape civil society and to educate or indoctrinate the populace, is just one example of that. but his reflections on the differences of the state and civil society in the East and the West flowed from his political goal of building a revolutionary socialist party in an advanced Western country. Gramsci wrote that in one of the early notebooks that he really couldn't theorize outside of, for its own sake, outside of an argument or some kind of a polemic that he was having to come to a conclusion around over real world problems. So likewise, it's hard to understand the contrast of the war opposition and the war maneuver independently of the debates in the communist movement over the importance of the United Front. Now recall that in the early years of the Communist Party of Italy, Gramsci was initially allied with Bordiga in taking the ultra-left view of the CP as a purist group that didn't sully its politics and alliances with other forces, even to the point of having virtual an after Mussolini our turn type position. Now Lenin actually directs several arguments at directly at leaders of the Communist Party of Italy in his left-wing communism book. Now, the Comintern developed the tactic of the United Front in the climate of reversal for the left. The argument was for the communists to ally with other workers' forces to struggle around immediate demands and to move to prove in practice the superiority of their politics and strategy over that of the reformists. Gramsci was won to this position and spent the last years of his active political life in Italy winning the party to those conceptions. And in the very unfavorable conditions of life under fascism, right, that was the situation that he faced. In the prison notebooks, Gramsci captures a lot of the writing about the war of position and war of maneuver in military history, although at one point he does caution against accepting a one-to-one correlation between military and political affairs. But there's one point in which he says that 1921 marks a period of passage from the war of maneuver to the war of position. And here he's referring to the failure of the March action in Germany, in which a young, recently formed Communist Party essentially tried to provoke a revolution by forcing workers on strike and launching military assaults on state forces. It was an abject failure. And in the Comintern, the United Front was developed as an explicit opposition to that, to the theory behind that, which is called the theory of the offensive, that the German CP advanced at the time. So that is that the idea that a small group, even one with hundreds of thousands of members at this time, that's what we're talking about, of revolutionaries could actually make a revolution on its own without majority support in the working class or in alliance with other social and political forces. The United Front was, you know, against that sort of idea. And in its historical context, Gramsci's stress on the war of position then is meant to underline the point that the British Marxist Chris Harman, that I will say, wrote a great pamphlet called Gramsci versus Reformism. That's a really old version of it. I don't know. I think it's actually on Marxist.org these days. But that the main context here is that Gramsci is saying that the revolutionary will of a few thousand revolutionaries at the time of crisis does not create the preconditions for a successful insurrection. These preconditions have to be prepared by a long process of political intervention and ideological struggle. So this was the live argument, not only in Germany, but also in Italy, because Bordiga held to many of those same ultra-left positions. Now, ironically, Bordiga opposed the United Front as, quote, a Russian import that didn't fit with Italian conditions. But if the war position is embodied in the United Front, the point of the United Front isn't to maintain alliances and a slow and plodding practice forever, and certainly not with wings of the capitalist class. Its aim is to win more and more workers through joint struggle to a revolutionary program as embodied in the Revolutionary Party. In the 1926 program of the Communist Party in Italy, that was laid out in that Gramsci and Togliatti actually co-wrote, the Lyon thesis. The fundamental purpose, of the United Front is, quote, to achieve an ever-increasing mobilization, organic unity of forces. Later, the theses talk about how the United Front can, quote, unmask the so-called proletarian and revolutionary parties and help the CP, quote, lead the masses to a majority. And as Harman pointed out, the war of position is still a war. It's not simply about a passing resolution somewhere. And at a certain point, when the class struggle reaches a pre-revolutionary situation, and the working class party is strong enough, the working class must go on the offensive. In other words, that must shift from a war of position to a war of maneuver. So in Gramsci's writing, the war of position is not conceived of as a replacement for the war of maneuver, but in some ways is a preparatory phase to a new offensive or to a new time in which a war of maneuver is the way to go. There's a dialectical relationship between them. So how will the Revolutionary Party know that the time is ripe for an offensive against capital and the state? It's not just that society faces a social crisis. You know, as Gramsci put it, when society showed morbid symptoms of dying before a new society can be born, but also when the revolutionary forces have achieved hegemony. Now, like the discussion of East and West, the concept of hegemony did not originate with Gramsci. In fact, it was used in the early Marxist movement in Russia to describe the program of the Russian social democracy, the idea of a democratic revolution to overthrow czarism under the leadership, or hegemony, of the working class. I mean, Lenin later developed this idea to speak of a revolutionary alliance of workers and peasants under the hegemony of the working class. But this didn't just mean leadership, but also a unity of the oppressed classes under the leadership of a working class, because the working class and its party projects a political vision that champions the oppressed and points a way forward to their liberation. Later, after the Russian Revolution, the term is used in Russia and in the common term to talk about the working class political hegemony or leadership in an alliance with the peasants in the workless state itself. Now, so when Gramsci's writing about hegemony, those are his immediate reference points, as well as observations that he draws from his study of Italian history, particularly the Risorgimento, which is the creation of the unified Italian state in the 1870s. In relationship to the socialist struggle in Italy, Gramsci is acutely aware of the need for socialists to advocate an alliance between the militant industrial workers of the North and the poor peasants of the South. In fact, one of Gramsci's main critiques of the trade union of the Socialist Party was its failure to do this. Instead, clinging to a narrow trade union perspective, which Gramsci used the term corporatist to talk about, rather than projecting a socialist vision on a national scale that, for instance, championed land reform for the peasants. So to Gramsci, the argument for hegemony had real-life consequences, because the Socialist Party's failure to establish that sort of hegemony contributed to the isolation of the factory council movement and the ruling class's ability to mobilize an army drawn from the peasantry against it. So while I would argue that's the proper context in which to understand Gramsci's writings on hegemony, the concept is used in different ways and takes on different meanings at different places in the prison notebooks. So I don't have the time to go through all of these. There's one of the books that's probably out in the Haymarket table by Gramsci's Pathways by Liguori. It's like a whole chapter on, you know, the uses and abuses of the term hegemony by both the different shades of meaning that Gramsci applies to it and then how other people have used it afterwards. But the concept is used in different ways and has different meanings. Now, I don't have the time to go through all of that, so I just focus on the relationship that is often talked about between the concept of force and the concept of consent. Now, in one passage, he writes that about how the modern parliamentary regime in Western Europe balances force and consent so that the ruling class maintains its domination, but does so by at least maintaining the notion that the majority of society, by having voted for parliament, or at least having the option to vote for parliament, gives its consent to its own domination. So a lot of academic commentators on Gramsci, especially people who use the Gramscian concepts to write about culture and the media and so on, make hegemony a kind of synonym for consent, and write about the various ways that the ruling class convinces or tricks the working class into accepting backward ideas and their own oppression. So while Gramsci's concept of the integral state does understand the state as including such sort of institutions that you would normally think of as being defined as part of, quote, civil society, organizations like the media, the schools, the political parties, the social organizations, he doesn't reject the notion that at its core the state is a coercive and repressive body. In fact, at one point he defines the state as dictatorship plus hegemony. There's other sort of formulations that are along those similar lines. So to summarize, to Gramsci, the ruling class rules through force and consent. In this way, it establishes its leadership or its hegemony over society. But it doesn't rule unchallenged, though. And in fact, it has to constantly adjust itself, for example, by making concessions to the oppressed and exploited to maintain its legitimacy. But even if it loses all of its legitimacy, that alone won't lead to its downfall. So you actually have to have an alternative class asserting its hegemony, its projection of wanting to lead, projecting a political vision and organizing the oppressed and exploited around it in order for a challenge to the existing order to be successful. And to get to that point, an alternative leadership must demonstrate its ability to organize and to lead society forward. To lead before it has power, to establish its, or in sort of Gramscian terms, to establish its political hegemony. At one point he writes, a class is dominant in two ways. Namely, it is leading and dominant. It leads the allied classes, it dominates the opposing classes. Therefore, a class can and must lead even before assuming power. When it is in power, it becomes dominant, but it also continues to lead. He later goes on to describe what he just said there as political hegemony, that the ruling class must, or the rising class must establish its political leadership before it has government power. So how will that be established? Well, here you need to go back to Russia in the common term, because the discussions of hegemony in those settings all related to the collective project of building revolutionary workers' parties. When Gramsci and other socialists of his generation wrote about projecting a hegemony counter to that of the ruling class, they were not talking about writing clever articles or producing transgressive art, although I'm sure Gramsci, you know, liked both of those things. But they wrote about counter-hegemonic work as part of the construction of a revolutionary party, what Gramsci labeled the modern prince in reference to Machiavelli's The Prince. Whereas the prince, you know, the Machiavelli thing, is something of a manual and strategy for an individual, Gramsci described the modern prince as a collective, a political party that's part of the struggle trying to lead it forward. He wrote in 1920, the fundamental and indispensable condition for attempting any experiment with Soviets is the existence of a cohesive and highly disciplined communist party that can coordinate and centralize the whole of the proletariat's revolutionary action in its central executive committee by means of its nuclei within the factories, unions, and cooperatives. And this is the conclusion he draws from the failure of the Socialist Party to lead the factory council movement forward. As someone who opposed the Socialist Party's passive approach, he advocates an activist party that wins hegemony in the way that he described the role of Wardini Nuovo in the Turin Factory Council movement. He notes how Wardini Nuovo nurtured the spontaneous struggle from below, but also wanted to give it greater direction and consciousness. It gave the masses a theoretical, this is him writing, it gave the masses a theoretical consciousness of being creators of historical and institutional values, of being founders of a state. This unity between spontaneity and conscious leadership or discipline is precisely the real political action of the subaltern classes. And insofar as this is mass politics and not merely an adventure by groups claiming to represent the masses. So the role he ascribes to the Nuovos, or the people who, you know, himself and his co-thinkers in Wardini Nuovo, is that later what he saw as the role of the modern prince. That his reference to a founding of a state pretty clearly is in line with his other explanations of hegemony, about leading before assuming power, and in fact establishing hegemony on the road to power. The actor here is clearly the subaltern classes, but the modern prince is the organizer. By founding a state, I think, at least my opinion, or my reading of it, is that he's talking about the working class showing that it can lead and can found the Soviet or council state that, you know, grows out of the factory council movement. And if you think about actually this role or this relationship between the subaltern classes and the modern prince, it's actually very similar to what Trotsky writes about in the History of the Russian Revolution, and that analogy about the piston, the steam in the piston box, you know, that which we can discuss in discussion. So as a theorist of a revolutionary party, he's very much a Leninist, writing as a Leninist, and he's not writing as some sort of social democrat. And we can put that off to discussion. So I'll try to wrap up here. So as I put this talk together, I realized that it's next to impossible to discuss as rich a set of theory and practice as that of Gramsci in the space of 35 or 40 minutes. So I've limited it pretty severely, I think. And what I've tried to do is to establish several propositions. One, that the various reformist readings of Gramsci are incorrect. Not only was Gramsci overwhelmingly hostile to reformist political currents during his active political career, but he remained so in his prison exile. Second, that the theoretical case on which the notion of Gramsci as patron saint of Eurocommunism is made, his writings on the East and West, the state and hegemony, misunderstand or distort Gramsci's reflections. Third, that much of what Gramsci wrote used the theoretical concepts and political frameworks that were very much in line with the revolutionary movement, of which the Bolsheviks and the Comintern were the chief representatives. Gramsci did develop those concepts further, but it didn't abandon his initial commitment to them. Finally, many of the concepts can't properly be understood unless they are connected to his understanding of the modern prince or the Revolutionary Party. So for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the difficulty, the coded and fragmentary nature of the notebooks, those assertions have been lost to many people who want to claim Gramsci today. Gramsci's penchant in the notebooks of making analogies between bourgeois history and the working class struggle sometimes injects that confusion where clarity is needed, and he never did explicitly confront the issue of Stalinism. But these are also byproducts of his isolation, writing in a prison cell, cut off from the living movement that pushed him along the path to becoming one of the 20th century's greatest Marxists. And there are many questions that for the working class movement that Gramsci could only pose. He was not able to resolve them in practice. And those are the challenges that he left for future generations of socialists, which we hope we will take up in discussion.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.